10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
And that energetic music comes from the wonderful show Sister Act that I'm sure a lot of you have heard of, know something about. It is about to open at the Racine Theater Guild and will run for the next several weekends. And I am at the Racine Theater Guild right now after the Tuesday night rehearsal, having just finished up. And with me is Doug Instanis, who is the artistic director of the Racine Theater Guild and director of this production of Sister Act. And also with us is Mary Lise Dorino, who is the choreographer for Sister Act. And this is a very dance-heavy show. So Mary Lee has had her hands full in filling the stage with spectacular dancing. And so I appreciate both of you joining me for a few minutes after a long evening of rehearsal. Doug Instanis, tell us a little bit about how Sister Act ended up in this season as the closer for the Theater Guild.
Well, actually, it was something we were looking at for a couple of years, but it wasn't released to community theaters until recently. We were so excited to get the rights to do it. I think the main reason, one, it has excellent parts for women, and we have some really strong women that have some wonderful voices, and it tells a good story. And I remember watching the movie with Whoopi Goldberg, and I loved it, and I thought it was great. And so I have fond memories of that, and it was a big hit on Broadway, and we thought it would just be a great show to bring to the Theater Guild. We could cast it well, we could produce it well, and plus it has a great message that we all need to be reminded of.
And the first point you made about a lot of good roles for women, what we should probably clarify there is that lots and lots of shows are tilted very much the other direction with many roles for men, and seems like women get the short end of the stick more often than you might realize, and it's really nice once in a while when things tilt in the other direction, especially, like you said, when we have so many gifted, talented, skilled women.
Absolutely, and we're very blessed. This is an excellent show, and they're doing an amazing job. So You know, and I kind of lied to Mary Lee, or I misspoke about it, because, oh, they're nuns. They don't, you know, they're going to just be in the choir boxes and do a lot of arm things. Well, that's not true. That is not true at all. They are moving and shaking, and maybe they're not tap dancing, but they are moving like crazy. Yeah. And they're getting an upper body workout for sure.
Very good. Maybe the two of you together can kind of not only tell the story of Sister Act, especially for the sake of those who don't really know what we're talking about or only know the title, and also maybe clarify how the stage show differs from the film, if we're talking to listeners who have seen the film, because I'm sure there are some differences.
Mm-hmm. The movie I would say the fundamental plot line is about the same. So there's a woman, she's a nightclub singer. She's trying to make it. She's not quite, struck the gold yet. And she witnesses, a murder. And so she goes into the witness protection program, which is essentially a convent. So she's trying to hide out and disguise herself as a nun while she kind of lays low, until the legal things get all sorted out. Obviously it's a huge clash, and she sticks out like a sore thumb, and then they all grow to love each other, and it's got a very happy ending. And so those things are fundamentally the same. The music is where you get a lot different. I was actually really kind of bummed when I first saw the show on Broadway. I was lucky enough to see the original cast on Broadway.
Wow.
And I'm like, where are all the songs? Where's I'll Follow Him? Where are, the songs from the movie? There is no original music from the movie in the show. The show is all its own original music. And I think the main reason behind that is copyrights and paying. Eight shows a week to do those songs. So it's just like nip it in the bud and do all original music. And this music is so fun. It is like, I dare you not to tap your toes.
Yeah.
And I think in the movie, they just did singing in performance mode. Now,
right.
Here it's a normal musical. Whenever I get emotion, I feel like I'm going to sing a song. So that's like a normal musical. The movie was just singing during performance. So that's... I think the play allows more emotion and to know what the characters are. I mean, a musical, you write a song because you have emotion and you want to share something maybe internal. And
mere words isn't enough.
And mere words, so I have to sing it. And so that allows you a lot of freedom in this play. And the end song where she sings Sister Act, just kind of sums up everything, and I can't believe it wasn't in the movie because it's such a good song.
Mm.
It talks about I don't need the spotlight, I don't need this, I don't need the crowd, I need my sisters by my side, and I see in them what I want to be. So I'm getting emotional just thinking about it because it's such a powerful song about what's important in your life, and it's family and friends and relationships and people and my sisters. So that's what you walk away with. And that's not it's implied in the movie. Mm-hmm. But it's so much more powerful in the play.
Right. The movie does not deliver it with that kind of emotional core the way this stage show does. That's for sure. There are a couple of really interesting relationships in the movie, and one of the chief relationships is between this nightclub singer turned nun, Dolores, and the Mother Superior. Describe the dynamics that are part of that relationship.
Well, it's certainly old school, and the whippersnapper, the Mother Superior is old school, rigid. We do certain things a certain way, and this is the way it's always been, and we have tradition, and here comes this person that challenges her in the way she conducts her life and what she thinks is important. Again, at the end where they talk about, are you going to come back? I'm going to come back. To pray? Well, maybe to sing. And we find out that, the love she has for her sisters is her faith, and the Mother Superior lightens up a little bit, and the Mother Superior is able to see Dolores as a wonderful human being and stands by her at the end and has a line about She is a sister. She is one of the best sisters we've ever had, or whatever
right,
she says.
Right.
And Dolores is able to respect the Mother Superior in her ways, and everybody gives a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's a great relationship, and both Robin and Jasmine are doing phenomenal.
Right. We should mention that the Mother Superior is Robin Wilkes, who's been on this stage. Robin Welch, who's been on this stage a number of times in a lot of different roles. But the woman portraying the role of Dolores is a newcomer to the Racine Theater Guild, and of course it's of critical importance with a role that important that you have somebody really first rate. Mary Lee, if I remember correctly, you knew this very, very talented singer even ahead of auditions.
Luckily,
tell us about your
I
encounter.
Did, yes. So I actually met Jasmine doing Rent at the Rhodey in Kenosha. And she walked in to audition for that, and I was just, you know, blown away by her voice, first and foremost, and then throughout working with her on that production, I realized, you know, she never complains. She always knows her stuff. She's just a bang-up person to work with, and I just could not sing her praises enough, and I'm so lucky. You know, I feel so lucky, I think we all do, that she agreed to be a part of this. You know, she's got quite the commute, so we're lucky to get her in that sense as well. So, she's nailing it.
Doug, it reminds me that, I mean, it's always exciting to welcome a newcomer to the Guild, especially in an important role, but it also can be scary if they are a complete newcomer and, in a sense, an unknown quantity. I mean, we might hear them sing really well and read really well in an audition. That doesn't mean we know they're going to be a pleasure to work with and fit in with the sort of the family here. And I suppose this is one of those instances where enough was known about her that you could cast her in very strong confidence and have no regrets.
Right, absolutely. And she is such a nice person by everybody that's worked with her that I felt confident that she would continue on. And again, you don't know why people come to the Theater Guild or why they come to theater in general. What are the reasons for it? Is it a stepping stone? Is it a place to meet people? Is it looking to be part of a community, or you're just going to be here and build your resume? Everybody comes to the Theater Guild for different reasons. And, you know, there isn't a right reason. It's just wanting to know what that reason is. And she's fit in great. We have a lot of new people in the show, which is very exciting to me because, you know, we're not going to grow and we're not going to be a strong organization if we just cast the same people over and over again. And we want new people at the Theater Guild. And I don't know, I think 6 or 7 people in the cast have never performed on our stage before, ever. And some of them haven't performed in 10, 15, 20 years. And it's like, you know, I always wanted to do this. And, you know, we say the only skill you need is desire. Just come on and give it a shot and, you know, work hard and mind your manners and, and you'll get along.
Yeah. This is probably a good time to acknowledge that the nuns in this show, I mean, who are in the ensemble of nuns, are not just a generic bunch of nuns, but that, I mean, there are some that actually are named nuns and have very distinct personalities, and just about everybody has kind of their own little moments in the sun. I mean, it's probably one of the things that makes it an especially fun show is that there isn't very much generic about these nuns, and they go on an interesting journey of their own.
Well, I think they, the idea is they start out generic, and then everybody's personalities get to shine, and Dolores brings out their individuality, and I think that's an important thing in the play. They can all of a sudden shake it up. You know, there's a little scene where she's trying to teach him to dance, and Marilee's got him, you know, follow me, step touch, and then all of a sudden, bring it up, and raise it up, and you know, she teaches them to sing, and they're all quiet, and they're shy, and then raise it up, and then they all start bringing their own thing to it, and we find out you can be an individual, and you can also be a united community. And I think that's, again, what it talks about. They're looking for people with to be able to sing to the Lord in whatever way they're able to. So, and the nuns are just kooky, and they're funny, and they're really well written. They're all very lovable, and they're also darn cute. And, you know, it's so fun to watch.
Yeah, and they are a wonderful array, that's for sure. I want you to talk in particular about the youngest of the nuns, who maybe is not even yet fully a nun. I don't remember her status.
She's
exactly.
a postulate.
Okay, so on her way.
I've been low on cash myself, but I never did that. That's one of the lines in the play when the thinks that she says prostitute instead of postulant.
And, yeah. So a nun in training, but her character is particularly interesting, it seems to me, and very poignant in terms of the journey she makes.
She starts off being very rigid and shy and following the rules, and then slowly but surely she comes to life, and at the end she stands up to Mother Superior and says, I've always followed the rules. I've never disobeyed, but I am standing up, and it's, you know, my sister needs me, and this is what I'm going to do. Mm. And she has this great song about living life and experiencing the things that she's never experienced. And there's so much out there, and she wants to learn. And she's going to stand with her sisters. And it's Waverly just is an amazing young actress who can interpret a song so well. It's excellent. And she really makes you love her and understand her journey to, be well-respected and to stand up for what you believe in. So people are really going to enjoy her performance.
Yeah. We should talk a moment about the fact that this show really is full of dancing, nearly from stem to stern, and actually for all the wonderful singers that we heard in auditions, it was in some ways almost a relief that there was that made it, in a sense, easier to...
Yeah. She had a little veto power there. Oh,
right.
Can't dance.
I mean, because,
sorry, she can't dance. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yes. I mean, because you just, to be in this show, you just have to be able to dance.
Have to.
And
yeah.
There's all kinds of dance that is involved. Just talk for a moment about the kind of challenges that this show poses
sure.
to you and to this cast.
Yes. Okay, so... many challenges, but so many successes as well. I would say the main challenge in this show for me was the traffic patterns and the bodies. Where are we going to put all the bodies so that they're moving around? They're not just standing in one place, but everybody's got a place in a line, and you follow her and you stand next to her. And like you said, almost everything is a production number. There's a big production number, then there's another one, then there's another one, then there's the finale. I mean, it's just nonstop. And the way I've described it to the cast is this show is an 80-mile-an-hour train. And if you fall off at some point, you're probably not going to get back on. It is just, it goes by so fast. So that was challenging. But then really, really fun also, growing up Catholic, listening to all of the lyrics and coming up with movements that are, you know, they are so incredibly clever. All of the double entendres with all of the, you know, Catholicism, it's just... The lyrics are so rich, and so coming up with movement to go to that was really, really exciting. I've actually been brainstorming for months before we started. And then challenging also in the sense where just when every single person is on stage, you know, yeah, they've got to, everyone has to have a home or else it is not organized chaos any longer. It is just chaos. So keeping all of that straight, I would say, was probably the trickiest part. But really, it's them more so than anything. They've got to know. And, you know, they rose to the occasion very well.
They've worked incredibly hard. That's for sure.
Choreographing 34 people on a thrust stage is very, very difficult. And to have all those people moving, because if one stops, it's a penguin thing. They all just knock each other down.
Totally.
You know. Right. And, of course, in a thrust, that really means the audience is right there to see it all. And so...
It's amazing.
Yeah, we're not seeing it at a distance the way you are with a standard proscenium, but it's like the dancers are coming to you.
Yes.
It's so exciting.
And it's challenging. And, you know, Doug actually made a really good point to me, if I'm lucky enough to keep working here, is that pretend like you're choreographing in the round, essentially. Like, don't even... just pretend like you're in the round, because you basically are. Mm. And so, you know, you think you're playing to all the angles, and then you see the whole number on its feet, and you're like... Oh, wow, I guess I could have made that, you know, out to the side a little bit more. I could have judged that a little bit more. So still learning, you know, about all of the ways to use this space, because it's a great space.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. Doug, I wanted to be sure to ask you about the fact that as the general manager here, you're also the one who has to probably have the biggest concern about the kind of things that are done here and the potential controversies that a given show can perhaps stir up because of its subject matter or the way certain sort of delicate matters are handled and so on. And I should think that whenever the Theater Guild does anything that sort of starts delving into the realm of religion in any respect, that's all that has to sort of at least give you pause, I should think. But I suspect that you believe Sister Act is a show that really handles these issues very skillfully and very respectfully, and that you don't have too much in the way of concerns about somebody kind of getting the wrong idea about this show.
I have to tell you, Catholics have the best sense of humor out of any religious denomination that I'm aware of. I'll tell you, the Catholics have taken a lot of abuse, from nonsense that we've done here to, making fun of black patent leather shoes, and, you know, making fun of nuns seems to be an okay thing to do. And, you know, my cousin actually is a nun. I think it is respectful because it talks about what religion is and putting butts in the seats and being there for the people and giving them what they want in a sense, and not in a commercial sense, but in a sense
what they need.
What they need, yes, and that how to reach people. And I do think religion in general struggles with that concept of tradition compared to new ways, and so I think it's a valid discussion. I think the more question that we had was the race discussion. This is 1970s, where people were called Negroes and black and colored, and we're past all those phrases. And there's a couple lines in the play about you're still a Negro, aren't you? And I tell you, the white cast didn't like that at all. And, the people that are African-American or Hispanic in the cast didn't have a problem with it. But the we don't say that anymore, And it was interesting because it's not meant in a racist way. It's just a description, and that's what people said back then.
Trying to be true to the time.
True to the time. However, we're doing it for a modern audience. Mm. And when a modern audience hears something, even if it's historically true and it's not meant to be disrespectful, it throws you out of the moment. And so we have changed a few things because I don't want the audience to think about that. I want them to think about the heartfelt song that's being sung and the meaning behind it. And if a word that was historically correct, 30 years ago throws you out of the moment, then that's not the author's intent. So I think in general it's really about two worlds coming together and realizing both are right. And I think the authors have done an excellent job with handling religion and race and just making it a universal story about two people with different opinions about life coming together and loving each other and respecting each other.
Right, so, rising above the differences.
Right. Nobody wants to be preached at. You're not coming to a play to get a race relations lecture or a religious lecture. You're here to see a story about people and how they care about each other and what they feel about the world and how that relates to us. And I think in this play, most people will be able to relate to the characters. They know, they have that crazy aunt or that that silly cousin that does this, or their grandma does this, and so I think everybody will find something that they can relate to, no matter what your religion is or what your race is.
Mm. We actually had some real nuns audition.
We did, but they couldn't dance. I'm sorry, you nuns. We wanted to cast you.
Going back to that, I think it just goes to show that if the nuns are going to come audition, it must be fine, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Very good point.
We should have put one in just to
make it okay.
Yeah, right. We have a real nun on stage.
So everything we're doing is fine.
Yeah, right.
Approved by the Catholic Church.
That's right. Just to finish out, I want each of you to pick out a moment in the show that is one of your favorites that you just want people to know about and maybe be waiting for.
Mary totally. Lee? Raise Your Voice is my favorite song in the show. It is, and it's hard to pick because, like I said, there are four powerhouse production numbers that are all feel good and really fun. But Raise Your Voice is the very first time that you really see these nuns start to tap into a personality that's been buried down in there that they may not even know they had. And it just, I get verklempt. I've gotten choked up watching them. I've gotten choked up listening to it.
And we
it
should
is
say,
just so fun.
And we should say that in no way is it a sad song. In no way really is it even a poignant song.
Yes.
But sometimes you get choked up just watching something that is
it
that transformative.
It makes you feel so good. You can't handle how good you feel. You have to cry about it.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I know
so
that
feeling. That's it for me.
Yeah.
Doug?
Well, I like a lot of them. It's probably a toss-up between the bedroom scene between Sister Mary Roberts, Waverly, and
yes.
Dolores about when she's leaving, mm. and she doesn't want her to go.
Yeah.
But I think if I had to pick one, it's the song Sister Act at the end that Jasmine sings. It just sums it up for me, and I can't even read the words to you because I get misty just thinking about the song. And it's just one person standing by herself thinking about her life and what she wants out of her life and what she missed out of her life.
Right. Well, and she thinks about all that she has striven for. Mm-hmm. And kind of realizes how empty all of that
yes.
actually
right.
is.
I mean, I don't need the spotlight.
Yeah, that's just not what it's about.
And maybe it's I'm around actors too much, but that's I don't need the spotlight. Yes, see, that's what it's about. It's about your brothers and sisters and your family, you know.
Yeah.
It's not about your spotlight, but
yeah.
she, you know, and she just, you know, and in that number, I should say, Mary Lee's Craig had a real fun fantasy dance because it starts off with her wanting these glorious things. And so Mary Lee's got these 70s dancers coming out and they're doing all the fun things, all the disco stuff. And then in the middle of that, she says, stop. And that everybody just walks off. And that to me is a really powerful moment where she says, I don't want this.
Right. She sees how empty it is,
yeah.
how meaningless yeah. it ultimately
it's
is.
It's definitely a turning point for her character.
Yeah. yeah.
Right.
So that I think that's what I like a lot.
Right. So, yeah, it's a great show that really mixes hilarity with real poignancy and seems to me just the right balance, and that's the mark of a really good show. So it opens this Friday. It runs for 3 weekends. And what do people do if they want to get tickets?
They can call the box office at 262-633-4218, or they can order tickets online at www.racinetheater.org or stop by the box office noon to 6 p.m., but don't wait too long. Some of the performances are already sold out. We have some shows with quite a few seats and some with not. So... call early.
Nice problem to have.
It is.
Well, what a great way to finish out this current season. And then, of course, without too much pause, on to the summer season. So it never stops here at the Racine Theatre Guild. Doug Instanis is the director of Sister Act and Mary Lee Storino, the choreographer. Thanks to both of you for talking about Sister Act today on The Morning Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't need a spotlight. I don't need a crowd. I don't need the great wide world to shout my name out loud. Don't need fame or fortune, nice as those things are. I've got all I need to feel like I'm a star. I've got my sisters by my side. I've got my sisters in love and pride. And in my sisters' eyes, I recognize the star I want to be. And with my sisters standing strong, I'm on the stage where I belong. And change that fact. I'm part of one terrific Sister Act.
Sister Act opens at the Racine Theatre Guild this Friday night. The time is 8:38, and you are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. Here's part two of today's program. We're going to spend this portion of WGTD's Morning Show with a woman by the name of Kristen Helms, who decided to make a very important decision when she became pregnant with her first child, namely to leave behind the only professional life she had ever known in corporate America. And it is a choice that, of course, confront all kinds of women, and different decisions can be made. And she's written a book about the decision that she made and about the steps she took to make her sort of the second phase of her life as happy and fulfilling as it could possibly be. Her book is called From Boardroom to Baby, a roadmap for career women transitioning to stay-at-home moms. It's published by Career Press. And Kristen M. Helms, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad we can talk to you about this interesting book and about your story, which, of course, very much runs parallel with the stories of all kinds of different women across the country. I want you to begin by telling our listeners a little bit about what you outline in the very first chapter of the book, in which you spell out your own story, beginning with when you were something of a entrepreneur at the tender age of 10.
Yes, when I was 10 years old, living in East Sacramento, I made my own business cards on my mother's electronic typewriter, and I passed them out to all my neighbors, and I sort of created a pet service or a dog walking service and babysitting service to all my neighbors. So I started my entrepreneurial side a little early, and, you know, that theme kind of always followed me throughout the rest of my life, just my drive for a good work ethic and always trying to succeed in everything you do. So it definitely laid the foundation for what was to come.
Right. So you tell us you essentially always had a job of one kind or another from the age of 14 to just before you turned 30. And that's when you became pregnant for the first time. You tell us being pregnant was not a surprise. This is something you and your husband wanted to have happen. I wonder, ahead of becoming pregnant, how much had you thought about the question of whether or not you would ultimately go back to work and so on? Had you taken the time to really explore that very much? The book sort of implies that perhaps you hadn't at least fully wrestled with what that was going to mean.
Absolutely. I think, you know, on paper and before I was actually pregnant, I always just thought, you know, I'm always going to keep building my career and I'm always going to be in the workforce. And so I just thought, you know, we'd add our first daughter and then I'd return to the workforce and keep, you know, building equity in myself, building my career. And it took me a little off guard that I had these other emotions and feelings that maybe that wasn't the only path for me right now. And so that's when I really started exploring, you know, after it was actually when I was on maternity leave that it really hit me that, you know, I think I'm going to veer off of my career course, at least for a period of time, and stay home with my daughter. So that those feelings did take me off guard in the beginning, definitely.
Right. I like how you describe how as you walked out of your job then to go on to maternity leave, it was with no sense at all of certainty that you weren't coming back, but in fact, you never returned to that office or to that life. And of course, one of the things that meant then is that you needed to, in a sense, find a new source of self-worth and self-identity. You needed to be able to understand who you were and what life was all about, given this gigantic change.
Absolutely. And I think that's what took me off guard and takes a lot of women off guard who make that decision to leave their careers and stay home for a while, is we're so accustomed to receiving external reinforcements from jobs like, you know, raises and praise and pats on the back and just interaction with colleagues on a daily basis. So to then leave that and, you know, if suddenly you're on the home front with a tiny baby, there's, you know, not much communication going on. You're not receiving, you know, your baby's not turning to you and saying, thanks for taking care of me today, or you really did a great job. You really have to then, you know, try to search for those same feelings of worth from within.
Right.
Internal strength, yeah.
You know, I think that's probably even more true now than it was, say, 20 years ago. And the reason I say that is because it seems as though the workplace in general has become much more attuned to assessment. And certainly in the world of higher education, which I'm also a part of, aside from the radio station here, that's very, very true. It feels like we're assessing everything all the time, and most of the time quite numerically. And so if that is a big part of the matrix against which you're working in the professional field, then suddenly you're at home with a baby and nobody's giving you an 8 or a 9 or a 10, and assessing your improvement in such and such. And I mean, suddenly all of that is away, and those feelings of accomplishing something, making progress, showing improvement, being worthwhile, that has to come from someplace else. It's not going to come from the sources it came from before.
Absolutely. I think you're exactly right that we, you know, and especially recently, it is such, you know, based on, you know, merit and, you know, advancing, and there's performance reviews, and there's, you know, there's different awards you can win. I don't know. There's just so much external reinforcement, and then to then be at home and not have that is definitely a change of pace, and you have no one to report to but yourself. Which was another just weird thing. You know, you don't have a boss who, you know, you're trying to impress, or you can say, like, look what I've accomplished this quarter. So it's striking how much power you have in your own hands as a stay-at-home mom. You know, just reporting to yourself and not being really held accountable for anything. You know, you can design this role however you like.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Kristen Helms about her book called From Boardroom to Baby, A Roadmap for Career Women Transitioning to Stay-at-Home Moms. This book is largely about her own experience of leaving behind a professional life in corporate America to be a stay-at-home mom, and some of the wrenching changes that created in her own life. You write at one point, this book is intended as a compass for career women turned stay-at-home moms to help navigate that transition. Say a word about what you wish you had when you made this transition. What would have made a difference to make that transition perhaps easier than it was for you?
Sure. You know, I think when you make that decision to stay home, you kind of have this rose-colored lens about how life's going to look at home with your baby, because you love your baby so deeply, or your children, you know, if they're older, and you just think, you know, I can't imagine going through any obstacles or hardships if I'm at home with my child. So I think, you know, it would have been so helpful if someone had just kind of warned me that you're going to go through some internal emotions. You know, of course it's going to be great to be with your baby every day, but you're also going to need to fill a kind of a void for your past career, like in your soul type of thing. So I think if someone just would have warned me, you know, all these kind of mixed emotions that come with it, and if I would have been more on the lookout for that, and just to know that those feelings were actually normal. You know, I've talked to a lot of stay-at-home moms who have gone through all these same emotions, and they say, you know, I felt so bad feeling these ways when I was lucky enough to stay home with my child. So just knowing that the feelings are normal and that you kind of do go through a big transition leaving career to stay home, but that you can find your groove and find your rhythm from the home front. Mm.
One very important part of your book is where you help a woman and presumably their life partner as well together make that decision about whether or not to stay at home. And you present quite a plethora of questions that you think they should pose to themselves and answer as honestly as they can. Without outlining every single question, because there's quite a few, just give our listeners a sense of kind of the scope of what you want somebody in this position to be thinking about and the kind of questions they should be asking themselves.
Sure. So, you know, in one of the very first chapters, I outlined that you should really take into consideration three things, and it's circumstance, values, and self. So before I made the leap, we did, you know, do our due diligence and ask ourselves some questions surrounding circumstance. So, you know, we didn't have any family in town to help with childcare. We crunched the numbers, and we were able to live off of one income. Of course, we'd have to tighten, you know, in certain areas, but we could make that happen. So circumstance really just, you know, your realities and, you know, what does it look like on paper? And then values, you know, my husband and I were both actually raised by stay-at-home moms, so we did find value in that lifestyle. We kind of knew what it looked like from the other side of it as a child. We liked our mom home all the time. So we found value kind of in that lifestyle, what we thought it would be. Self, that's the thing that I didn't really know that I had to to look at when I made the decision. And that's, you know, can you picture yourself as a stay-at-home mom? You know, are you the type of person, are you a type A personality who's very organized, or are you, a more career woman who, if you did leave that big part of yourself behind, maybe should you look at starting like a side business from home while you're home, or a project or a hobby, you know, something that's going to give you a little bit more life outside of motherhood. So I kind of, you know, go through, and I think when you look at the whole big picture, those things combined, your circumstances, your values, and then yourself, and you read through, I lead you through an exercise where there's a bunch of questions, but you read through all your answers, you kind of can start to see like a certain path kind of illuminating in which direction that you should maybe go towards.
Right. I really also appreciate the way in which you kind of sort out the way we can kind of look at what did that early life give to me? What did I enjoy about it and appreciate from it and take from it that I'm probably not going to get in this next phase should I decide to leave that life behind and become a stay-at-home mom? For you, I think personally, for instance, it was, for instance, the sense of structure that one has when one works in corporate America. That is something that might not be present in this new life, or certainly not in the same way, or maybe it's a case of you need to try to make sure that you create as much structure as you can in this next phase, but it's not going to be just there on its own. I thought that was really intriguing, and I suspect that for every person, this kind of thing is going to play out a little bit differently.
Absolutely, and it will depend on, obviously, like personalities and what you need in order to thrive. I talk about that a lot, asking yourself, what do you need in order to thrive? And you're right, for me, I was used to structure. I was used to, you know, to-do lists and being able to check things off my list and big goals. So I sort of realized early on in my journey through stay-at-home motherhood that I had to kind of set up this role in that way in order for me to thrive. So, you know, it's funny, I would start checking in with myself, you know, instead of having, I called it meetings with the boss, you know, kind of with yourself, to kind of stepping back from the daily grit of, you know, raising tiny humans and just evaluating like, okay, what can I pat myself on the back on? What have we done that's, you know, really great? Or what do I need to work on? But aligning everything, every aspect of my role, kind of mirroring how I was in the workforce. With a lot of structure.
I appreciated, too, how you realized for yourself that in your professional work, doing creative work was really, really important. And one can see how very easily that could be sort of left behind, very much left out of the equation altogether when one finds yourself as a really busy stay-at-home mom. I mean, what? And, of course, in fact, there are opportunities, and especially if we're aware of it and try to create those opportunities to be creative, versus only realizing way after the fact that in being a stay-at-home mom, you ended up sort of leaving out something that was really important to you and not realizing it until you're looking back with regret. I suppose part of the point of this book is to try to think of those things ahead of time, and to try to create a stay-at-home mom experience that can include these things that are important to you but that might really easily get lost in the mix.
Absolutely. When I remember in the early days as a stay-at-home mom, my daughter, you know, when they're babies, they nap all the time. So you're all of a sudden you have a lot of downtime. And I remember she was napping one day, and I was wandering around the house. I went in and checked on her. She was still sleeping. And I just thought, I feel a little lost inside of my own home. Like, you know, the chores had been done. I didn't know what to do. And so I opened up my laptop, and I was like, you know, I'm just going to start writing down my feelings. started into a mommy blog, actually. And it was just I realize it now that was a creative outlet for me that I needed, and something that I, you know, the creative side of me in a marketing and PR position before becoming a stay-at-home mom, I really needed to exercise that creative side of me. And I think that you know, motherhood lends itself to that, because there are, I mean, in the early days, there are breaks when the kids nap, or, you know, in the evenings, you know, they go down to bed early. There are little pockets of time that you can find. And if it's, you know, if you're not creative, or maybe you like crafting, or maybe, you know, whatever it is that you need from your past career life, or that kind of fills your cup back up, you can find these pockets of time and express yourself and really in a really creative way.
Mm. I know that one facet of your own experience were a couple of things you needed to work on that you knew you weren't particularly good at, or these would be points of, let's say, weakness as a stay-at-home mom, and one of them was patience. You needed to work on patience. You needed to work on functioning with a little less control over everything. I'm just curious, how did you work on those particular things? And whatever people's weaknesses are, how would you suggest they work on those weaknesses?
Yeah, well, I think the biggest part of that is just identifying what it is first, right? So in my past career life, it actually worked to my advantage to be kind of less patient, because it was a very fast-paced marketing role. You know, I kind of kept projects moving. I didn't have a lot of patience or time for stuff, but we produced quality work, but patience was kind of, you know, it worked in my favor not to be super patient and relaxed. But then as a mom, we all know, you know, you need a lot of patience. And just as soon as you think you have it all figured out, then there's a growth spurt or a development with your child, and then you have to refigure it all out. So just, you know, for patience, and now I have two toddlers, a 2- and a 4-year-old, so now I'm really channeling all the patience. But it's just, you know, you just constantly are learning, and I'm constantly just checking myself again and again. And just so I think that, you know, the biggest thing is just knowing your weaknesses and just keeping those in the forefront of your mind. So, you know, when you find yourself becoming, you know, less patient with your children, or, you know, getting a little annoyed at things, then you can be like, okay, I need to just take a breath, you know, kind of realize the bigger picture here, and then move forward.
When do you think somebody ideally should read this book? I mean, at what point in their life, in terms of before they're even pregnant, or while they're pregnant, or just before they have their baby, or just after they come home with the baby, when do you think would be an ideal time to read this book and explore some of the possibilities and suggestions outlined in it?
You know, I think there's a couple different answers, because I kind of made it in a way that it would touch a lot of different women at different journeys or at different points in the motherhood journey. So definitely this would be a great one if you're considering leaving your career to stay home, because it's sort of a what to expect when that happens. And then to the new mom who maybe is on maternity leave or has just left her career to stay home and is really fresh in those new feelings, fresh in that new transition, this would definitely resonate. And, you know, even seasoned mothers, I've had a few actually stay-at-home moms who have been stay-at-home moms for almost 10 years, and I just, you know, I'm getting some feedback from them saying, wow, thank you for saying these things out loud and, like, making this more normal to talk about, because they had been feeling all these kind of obstacles and dealing with it sort of silently, and now these are conversations that are being had and saying, you know, it's okay to have these feelings, but here's how to work through them, and here's how to build a life that's thriving at home.
Hmm. The book, again, is From Boardroom to Baby, A Roadmap for Career Women Transitioning to Stay-at-Home Moms, published by Career Press, the author Kristen M. Helms. Kristen Helms, thank you so much for writing this book and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we look forward to the monthly visit of Nan Calvert, with a program devoted to an environmental topic of interest. Friday was supposed to be comedian Paula Poundstone. Unfortunately, she was forced by illness to cancel her recording schedule for yesterday, so we do not have that. But we're going to go into the archives and bring out some marvelous moments, morning show moments with Alan Alda and Bob Newhart. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. Newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Info at jackandrea.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance career in teaching. Convenient